Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Raiders of the Shadow, an Adam Kane and Copernicus Smith adventure, The Human Chronicles Legacy Series, Book 1, by T.R. Harris. Narrated by Keith Sellenwright. Chapter 1.
Whoever designed this ship should be shot, Copernicus Smith cursed under his breath.
He was ensconced in a too-small access tube in the forward section of the Borkus-class freighter, struggling with a replacement focusing ring that refused to lock into place. He'd been at it for several hours, and still the stubborn part refused to cooperate. Coop had a remote camera hovering near the receiver coupling with a monitor affixed to the metal wall of the access tube, showing him what he was up against. Earlier, he'd cut the internal gravity to this section of the ship and now had a magnetic belt around his waist to keep him stationary in the tube. The lack of gravity helped with the repairs, which were twofold at this point. As a top-notch starship repairman, Copernicus knew what the problem was. When he'd initially removed the old focusing ring, the gripper unit tweaked the receiver coupling a little too much, bending the flange. Now the threads on the new unit weren't engaging, and before he could replace the focusing ring, he would first have to repair the bent flange. The job involved the use of a pair of high-tech pliers, for lack of a better word. In reality, the device looked like a tinker toy version of a crab with multiple appendages jutting out from the central hub. Everything in the tool was electronic and under Coop's expert control. In fact, all the equipment he had with him was familiar and state-of-the-art. He needed them for his business. So it was especially embarrassing when he kept losing the grip on the flange as if it were coated in oil. Unfortunately, it was. That was Coop's first solution at screwing in the new focusing ring, thinking the threads were just rough with corrosion. They weren't. The flange was bent, which he knew now. At the time, he didn't, and had coated the entire apparatus with oil. Now it was making grabbing the metal flange near impossible. Copernicus shook his head from exasperation, which was a professional no-no. He made his living by repairing old, broken-down, and mistreated starships. If everyone followed maintenance schedules and tended to minor upkeep, major repairs would be few and far between. But what bothered Copernicus the most was the annoying fact that this particular Borkus-class freighter was his. And how would it look if a starship repairman couldn't keep his own ship running? He blew out a deep breath in the quiet of the access tube while justifying his current predicament. As he saw it, after working all day or several days repairing a spaceship, the last thing he wanted to do when he got back to base was work on his own. That philosophy was coming back to bite him in the ass. He checked his watch, shaking his head in disgust. For 9 hours, the Star Surfer had been dead in the water. When focusing rings went bad, that was what happened. As the name implies, the rings focused the gravity energy from the generators at a specific point about 1,000 miles ahead of the ship, feeding enough into the confined space to initiate a microscopic black hole. Since energy and matter are different manifestations of the same thing, it took an incredible amount of energy, but that's what the generators were designed to do. The black hole would only stay in existence for a millisecond before it would dissolve and be replaced with another. That was how faster-than-light travel worked, by creating a series of small black holes and enclosing the originating starship within the event horizon. Space in all directions would be drawn toward the tiny black holes, and when they dissolved, space would rebound, taking the starship with it. Through this process, the ship moved through space by falling toward the singularity rather than being propelled. And with the originating generator solidly within the influence of the event horizon, there was no time dilation or other effects as defined by Einstein. It was a pretty slick arrangement, when things worked correctly. and every faster-than-light ship had double sets of focusing rings positioned forward and aft. Larger craft, such as Jurian and Union warships, had designated compartments for the rings, with stations for 5, 8, or up to 20 rings, depending on the size of the ship. But in smaller spacecraft, along with most cargo vessels, the ship was designed first and then the focusing rings stuck in places according to their required spacing. This meant ring stations could be anywhere, in sleeping compartments, cargo holds, or even along obscure access tubes where prodigious amounts of internal wiring were found. That was the case with Koops Borkus. In most situations, that was fine. Focusing rings rarely went bad. But when they did, it was a bitch to replace them. Koop had plenty of replacements on board, and as mentioned, he had the proper tools and equipment for the job. It was just that the placement of this ring was especially problematic, eliciting the sentiment that whoever designed this ship should be shot. Apparently, the engineers never personally replaced a focusing ring in a Borkus-class freighter. If they had, they would have planned it better. It was a jarring experience 9 hours earlier when the Star Surfer let out a pitiful moan and then abruptly dropped out of the gravity well. Koop was napping in his compartment at the time with the ship on autopilot, heading for his next job site. He rushed to the bridge and checked the status boards. He cringed when he learned the location of the defective ring, knowing there was nothing accessible about the access tube. It was merely a cramped void where wires and ducting ran. He had to remove a section of passageway panels even to reach the area, and then reroute several critical runs so he could squeeze past. Cutting the internal gravity helped, but still, the going was slow. It took 4 hours before Koop could even reach the focusing ring. In hindsight, it would have been faster if he'd dumped the atmosphere in the Star Surfer and accessed the device from outside the ship, along the hull. But at a point, it became a matter of principle that he squirm his way through a river of wires to reach the coupling station. The ring itself came out without a hitch. The real frustration came when he tried to screw in the new one. At the time, he didn't know the flange was bent, which caused his temper to flare, sending a symphony of swear words echoing off the metal walls. He was into his 6th hour of the repair when he discovered the real problem. That changed his tactic and sent him scurrying out of the access tube for more tools. But now, Copernicus Smith was making progress. According to what he could see on the monitor, his repair of the coupling was successful. Even the oil sheen was less now that he'd cleaned off the flange and the gripper tool. He positioned the focusing ring at the leading edge of the coupler and pressed the button on the handle of the gripper. The ring began to spin slowly. He felt the contact through the metal bar and a few seconds later sensed the meshing of the threads. 5 seconds later, the ring was in place and locked down. He closed his eyes, savoring the relaxing sensation of floating in zero-G. But he didn't have time to waste. He worked the datapad he had with him and was rewarded when the ring lit up, its bluish tinge reflecting around the myriad of obstacles to fill the so-called access tube with light. He was done with the repair. However, things were far from normal. A few minutes later, a sweat-soaked Copernicus was on the bridge, opening a link with the Rhinus cartel and Sand Vors, the being who gave him his latest assignment.
"Good news, son," Koop said. "I have my ship running again. I can be on site in about 12 standard hours.
The green-faced alien made his best impression of a grimace. "That is news of a varying kind, Copernicus. It is good that your ship is running, but unfortunate that the repair contract has already been given to another entity."
"You gave away my contract?"
Koop asked incredulously. "As you know, our ships cannot be left for long without mobility. There are too many risks to be faced."
But I can be there in half a standard day. You've waited this long, can't you wait a little longer? After all, what are the chances someone will find the ship?
San's eyes grew wide.
The chance is high. This particular vessel had only recently raided a cargo ship from Formule. It was carrying a substantial cargo of electronics. As you know, devices of true Formulean design and construction are expensive and most sought after. Our ship is towing a string of 10 pods. The value of the cargo is immense. Others will seek out the crippled vessel, especially with this kind of cargo. In addition, the Jurians have dispatched a Class 3 to track down the raider. It will be on site in 2 standard days. We have no room for error. If they find the ship, the crew will be obligated to destroy both the vessel and the cargo, as is our policy. That we cannot allow to happen.
And you can get someone out there faster than me?
Yes, it has been guaranteed.
Who did you get?
Coop saw the alien grimace again, saying all Copernicus needed to know.
Not Canoris, that slimy-skinned bastard.
He has a ship in the vicinity. I had no choice. It was untimely that your vessel experienced difficulties. But I can assure you, Copernicus, there will be future business. There is always business for beings such as yourself and Canoris.
Although Coop understood the urgency, the cartel couldn't afford to have one of their raiders broken down for long. He was still pissed that he'd lost the assignment, and to Canoris of all creatures. Copernicus depended on the Rhinus cartel for most of his business. There weren't many legitimate repair shops that would service ships with ties to organized crime, and Copernicus specialized in such questionable work. The money was great, and the damn cartel ships broke down on a regular basis, coming as they did from a hodgepodge fleet of stolen or derelict vessels. It kept Copernicus busy as long as he could fulfill the contracts and keep his mouth shut. This recent setback would cause his reputation to suffer, but it wouldn't be enough for him to lose all his business. Just some of it. After a few more minutes of expressing his displeasure with the turn of events, Coop amicably ended the conversation with San, not wanting to bite the hand that fed him. Then, with another grim shake of his head, Coop turned the Star Surfer around and headed back home, his tail figuratively between his legs. After a quick shower, Coop opened a secure link with Earth, routing the continuous wormhole call through several relay stations to hide its destination. He didn't stop to think what time it was on the distant planet, and when his handler came on the screen, the man was propped up on one elbow in his bed, shirtless and rubbing his eyes to gain focus. Once he recognized Copernicus, Kellen Drake sighed, his emotion indeterminate.
Did you get your ship running?
I did, but San already gave away the contract. Sorry.
Kellen pursed his lips.
You wouldn't have this problem if you let us give you a decent ship, one that wasn't a flying junk pile.
No can do, boss. I have to keep up appearances. Getting a new ship would raise too many questions.
I suppose you're right.
And in other news you're not going to like, I found out the Rhinus ship was carrying a cargo of genuine Formulean electronics. That sucks.
It does, but it's not unexpected.
40% of the Rhinus raids have been on Formulean cargo ships. That's way beyond coincidence.
We've discussed it before. They're specifically targeting Formulean shipments. How they know when and where the ships will be transiting the Shadow is the big mystery.
But no matter how you slice it, that ship would have taken priority. We could have tracked it back to their base. Kellen held up his hand to stop Coop's protest.
I know. If they have a central base.
But that's what you're out there to find out.
I don't think they do. The Rhinus is not run like the Gratis cartel, with military ranks and central bases. These guys are more like a bunch of pirates with only a loose affiliation. Even so, they are a pretty well-organized bunch of pirates.
I've heard your argument before, Coop. But there still has to be a leader, and whether he, she, or it is on a planet, in a spaceship, or on a space station, he, she, or it needs to be found.
Roger that, Coop agreed. But first, it would be nice to have a name.
Kellan smiled, his face lit only by the light from the screen. Someone shuffled next to him in bed. The spy chief's wife was used to these late-night calls, especially since he ran a network of agents spread across the galaxy.
Keep at it. I assume you'll get another contract soon. Those Rhinus pieces of shit can't help but break down.
Coop nodded.
Job security, boss. And yeah, something will come along. I just hate wasting nearly a week for nothing, and especially letting such a high-priority cargo slip between our fingers.
These things happen, Kellan said.
In the meantime, you might check that lead you have on Reznor.
That sounded promising.
It's better than nothing.
Will do. It's on the way back to base. I'll keep you informed.
Now, get back to your beauty sleep. God knows you need it.
Sir?
Yeah. And screw you too, Mr. Smith.
Drake out.
The Rhinus cartel was a relatively recent thorn in the side of the Earth-run Orion Cygnus Union, credited with some of the more spectacular raids along the Union and the expansion border, with an emphasis on Formelian cargo vessels. Both sides were anxious to learn more about their activities and organization. Although Coop worked for Earth Intelligence, he was sure some of his intel was being traded to the Jurians for reciprocal intel on a variety of subjects. There was a tenuous peace between the two galactic empires, one that had existed for going on 12 years. However, the activities of the Rhinus were causing tensions to increase as each entity wanted the right to pursue the raiders wherever necessary, even if it meant crossing borders. But the cartel knew of the restrictions and used the border as a means to avoid capture. They would make raids on one side and then bolt across the border where their pursuers had no authority. It was a game they played, and it caused a slew of border-crossing incidents between the Union and the expansion. Copernicus was tasked with locating the central headquarters of the cartel and devising a plan to take it out. That was assuming that the cartel had a central headquarters. Copernicus didn't think they did. Unlike the Gradis, which was the largest criminal organization in the galaxy, the Rhinus was more decentralized. They existed everywhere and nowhere at the same time, and they had an uncanny knack for dodging the authorities, at least when their ships were running. A breakdown made them vulnerable not only to arrest and confiscation, but also to tracing the ship's movements over time. As a result, crews had standing orders to destroy their vessels rather than have them impounded. That told Earth Intelligence a lot. They were willing to lose ships and cargo to keep their central command a secret. Copernicus, more than most, had access to some of the Rhinus cartel ships, the ones that broke down. And as he worked on them, he would tap into internal navigation systems and draw data from the computers before relaying that information back to Kellan Drake. Earth equipped him with the latest technology for achieving this, which was also a problem. Should he get caught with the equipment, there would be no denying his true identity as a deep-cover spy. The tech was far too advanced for a simple starship repairman. And if he were caught, it wouldn't only be the cartel ship that was blasted to atoms by the crew. It would be Copernicus Smith as well. The cartel didn't mess around when it came to security breaches.
Chapter 2
The planet Reznor was a pleasant-looking world of blue, brown, and green, like most worlds suitable for prime life in the galaxy. Or at least it used to be. What made Copernicus scowl with contempt was what happened to it over the past 10 years, as reflected in the gaudy and confusing cluster of cities that had sprung up on its surface.
One would think that new would mean modern and well-planned. But that wasn't the case here. On Reznor, the phrase best used to describe urban planning was hurried and cheap. There was no plan, just a rush to construct as many buildings as possible in the relatively few flatlands on the northern continent. With cold fusion power and water reclamation technology available, the settlements could be built anywhere a solid foundation could be laid without regard to traffic flow or natural resources. In a way, the planet reminded him of his beloved Liave III, whose name had since changed to Navaris, the world where he had his first starship repair facility. When he was there, Coop lived in the quaint coastal enclave of Balamar on a beautiful and tranquil crescent-shaped bay. That was until the city of Kanak sprung up nearby. That cesspool of depravity soon came to dominate the area around Balamar, eventually morphing into an ugly metropolis of over 2 million creatures of nearly every shape, size, and description. Copernicus was glad he didn't live there anymore, leaving Balamar and his long-abandoned repair facility to his friends Sherry Valentine, Adam Kane, and Riyad Tarazi. And now Reznor was following the same progression, from peaceful paradise to overcrowded slum. And what was even more depressing about the similarities was the fact that, although Reznor was 38,000 light-years from Navaris, both planets came to be the way they were from the same inciting incident. And that was when Kreshon, the Mad Heiress, began his reign of terror through a swath of the Kedis frontier that would later become known as the Dead Worlds. With seemingly unstoppable force spawned from the alien's 3 billion-year-old technology and his immortality, Kreshon ravaged over 100 worlds in the region, creating in the process the largest mass migration of living creatures ever seen in the Milky Way. The rich, powerful, and well-connected fled the Kedis in droves ahead of the destruction, seeking out the farthest reaches of the galaxy from the dead worlds as a way to delay the inevitable. Kreshon's complete domination of the galaxy. Although the planets in the systems around Reznor weren't the farthest from the Kedis at the time, the area was some of the least populated in the galaxy, situated along a remote stretch of border between the human Orion Cygnus Union and the Jurian expansion. Initially, the area was just a line on a map, located along what the humans called the Pegasus Arm, when humanity declared that the so-called far arm of the Milky Way would forever be known as human space. At the time, neither empire cared much for this throwaway region of the galaxy. Humans never ventured into this part of space until recently, although it had been part of their union for over 20 years. And the Jurians only occasionally visited the region throughout their 4,000-year-long reign as the masters of the expansion. The small cluster of 19 star systems was discovered by accident, hidden as it was behind the immense gravity influence of a globular cluster along the outskirts of the Pegasus Arm called N421. It was only through the effects of gravitational lensing that it was learned the systems existed. As spaceships entered the region, the stars appeared to move faster as their true locations became known behind the immense gravity source. Early explorers facetiously labeled the area the Shadow because it was obscured from the main part of the galaxy by the gravity shadow of N421. Then everything changed. 10 years ago, hordes of frightened yet well-off immigrants flooded into the area using the Yaster space lane that ran nearby for access. The Shadow was well hidden and of little importance to the rest of the galaxy, meaning that it would be the last place Kreshon would focus his attention. And the planet Reznor was the first world one came to when entering the region. The primary space lanes ran above the ecliptic plane, away from 99% of the mass of the galaxy, where rogue gravitational influences were nil. To achieve truly impressive faster-than-light speeds, space had to be free of even the most negligible gravitational influence, be it from stellar bodies or other gravity-drive starships. The space lanes provided this clear space, and the Yaster lane was one of the widest to be found, allowing for a large volume of traffic where the truly massive behemoths could crank up their gravity wells without interference. And so the immigrants came, dropping from the Yaster near Reznor before moving to the more developed planets within the Shadow. At the time, Reznor was an undeveloped planet with a primitive native population of basic primes. Their culture was similar to early communities on Earth, with a functional written and spoken language. The natives, called Selvans, were clustered in vast cave-based settlements, mainly across the northern continent. They knew of mechanical power, telescopes, and even basic electricity. Unfortunately, that was the extent of their technology, meaning they had nothing to offer the pampered and spoiled aliens invading the region. Hasty settlements were constructed on Reznor by the invading horde, primarily as a staging ground for those arriving and moving to the more developed planets farther in. The natives posed no challenge for the newcomers, and there was little conflict between the Selvans and the aliens, not after the first few bloody encounters. After that, the natives became almost beasts of burden, integrating slowly with the alien communities. Very few established businesses from the expansion settled on Reznor. There were more opportunities on the core worlds of the Shadow. The one exception was Xanfi. To Copernicus it made sense. As the second largest weapons company in the galaxy, the environment on Reznor was perfect for Xanfi and their products. It was a planet with no law, using only force of will and weapon to enforce whatever conventions were established. The facility assembled a supply of their long-barreled energy weapons, employing primarily native labor in the effort and selling exclusively to the residents of the Shadow, thus cutting out the middleman. They also had a new line of weapons they called Line of Sight, which Copernicus didn't quite know what they meant. Every weapon they produced was Line of Sight. You sight the target, press the targeting computer button, and then wait for the beam to lock on. There was no great mystery in it. It was the same with the Maris Clis handguns, which also had computer targeting. Copernicus smiled. The slight delay as the computer locked on target had saved his hide a dozen times in the past. He didn't see that changing any time soon. It was probably just some advertising gimmick, the new and improved same old shit. Either way, Xanfi was making a killing selling weapons on Reznor as well as other worlds in the Shadow. No pun intended. Although Copernicus had only been working his current assignment for a little over 6 months, he had been to the planet dozens of times. With his particular brand of clientele, he avoided the more civilized worlds in the region. The people of Reznor didn't bother with such trivial things as law and order, using an ad hoc system of supply and demand instead. Every activity on the planet was governed by pragmatism. If an activity or service were needed, then someone would fill the void. And if these entrepreneurs had the power or savvy to hold their positions, they would do so. If not, then others would take their place. It was Coop's job to supply starship repair services to the criminal element in the Shadow, and primarily the Rhinus cartel. Unfortunately, he wasn't the only one. Canoris was one of the early refugees to the region and had been filling this role for years. And he didn't much appreciate an upstart like Copernicus elbowing his way into his territory. The slimy-skinned bastard had a fleet of 6 repair vessels and a solid reputation. Coop was only able to make inroads with the help of Kellen Drake and Earth's intelligence services laying the groundwork for his introduction. And with the secret backing of Earth, this allowed Coop to undercut Canoris on just about every job, which was essential to thieves, pirates, and cutthroats. It helped contribute to their bottom line. Of course, his presence in the Shadow made him and Canoris competitors, if not enemies. But there was plenty of work to go around, and even more after the Rhinus cartel moved into the area. If not, then Canoris would have to put a stop to Coop long before this. Copernicus set the Star Surfer down in a disorganized mess of a spaceport outside the urban blight known as Dashius. From the air, the city looked more like an enormous burn mark across the landscape, still smoldering from the devastating fire. Upon closer examination, the town was merely made up of...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?